This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending part of your day with me. Susan Rice was UN ambassador and national security advisor in the Obama administration and served in two roles on the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. In her new memoir, you'll learn that Vladimir Putin is long-winded on phone calls, that she was once called the N-word by a high school coach whom she admired. She then dropped the F-bomb, and that her daughter was suspected of possibly having a brain tumor, but her illness was the result of the trauma from watching her mom repeatedly beaten up over Benghazi. The book is one part lesson in recent geopolitical history, one part self-examination, and one part pure personal sharing from a woman who writes, quote, "From what I was eventually told by close colleagues, I was perceived as smart, dynamic, decisive, bureaucratically skilled, and tough, but also brash, demanding, impatient, hard-headed, and unafraid of confrontation. Some have also dubbed me imperious, autocratic, and intolerant of dissent." You can make up your own mind by reading Susan Rice's new book called Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. It is nice to see you.
Good to be with you, Allison.
So you begin the story with an ending, January 20th, 2017. It starts like every other day, even though it is the last. Why did you start that way?
Well, I wanted to take people back to the end of the Obama administration. And it really was a way of putting a closer on what had been a very vital time in my life. The title of the prologue is Farewell to the Moral Universe. And I picked that because, as some people will know, the carpet in the Oval Office when President Obama was president had a quotation that was attributed to Martin Luther King about the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. And my point throughout the book is, you know, as individuals, as parents, as policymakers, as human beings and citizens, the arc does bend toward justice, but only if you and I and each of us do the bending. We can't be bystanders, particularly in these difficult and important times. We have to contribute. We have to be on the field, in the game, and make a meaningful difference. And so, as you said, the book is a lot of different things. It is very personal, sometimes even raw. It does talk about the issues that I worked on in the Clinton and Obama administration, talks about my kids, talks about my marriage and my parents and all of that, where I came from. But it's also in some ways, particularly in the end, a call to action and a reminder to each of us that we have more in common than we have that divides us. But if we lose sight of that, if we allow our divisions to define us, we're going to decline as a democracy, as a nation, as a global leader. And I urge us not to let that happen.
In the introduction, you mentioned that there were so many things that you wanted to say, but you couldn't because you were in government, because you were in service. Obviously, Benghazi, we'll talk about that later. But I'm interested, when you sat down to write the book, what were some of the other issues that you would like to have addressed at the time, but you couldn't?
Well, the policy issues I did address at the time, it didn't always necessarily reveal what I was recommending or what I was thinking. So because when you're on a team, you give your advice in confidence, and the president makes a decision. And if you are on board, you salute and move out. And that's what I did. And always knowing that if ever I couldn't salute, that I had the option of departing. But this is an opportunity not only for me to talk about some of the important issues that I was able to work on, but really what I wanted to do, Allison, was to share my story. Going back to my parents and grandparents, you know, on the one side of my family, I'm the granddaughter of immigrants from Jamaica who came to Portland, Maine in 1912, which was rather unusual, and raised five kids. And though they had no education, they were a janitor and a maid. They sent all five kids to college, and they all went on to be quite accomplished professionals. On my dad's side, I'm the descendant of slaves from South Carolina, and my father served at Tuskegee with the airmen during World War II. And my parents' histories and experiences shaped me. My upbringing in Washington, D.C. during the 60s and the 70s shaped me. So I really wanted to spend time explaining how I became who I am, rather than being subject to, I think, the caricatures or characterizations, mischaracterizations that emerged about me on both the left and the right when I became such a prominent figure in the Obama administration.
Let me ask about your parents. It's interesting because there's a distinction there between the way your father was raised. I think it was, what is it, Sue Pearl? Sue Pearl was the grandmother, and being a Tuskegee Airman before Truman integrated the Army in 48, versus coming from your mother's side of immigrants. How do they differ when they talk to you about race and race in the United States based on their individual backgrounds? And what was different, what was the same?
It's interesting. On my father's side, my father experienced, you know, the rawest form of Jim Crow segregation. Born roughly around 1920, when lynching was nearly at its height in the Deep South, and his experience of race was about as bald and painful as any. And he had a very interesting philosophy about it, which he developed when he became a grown man and a professional, which is essentially, if my being black is going to be a problem, it's going to be a problem for somebody else, not for me. In other words, he wasn't going to let this pervasive racial prejudice that he was steeped in undermine his own sense of self and his own sense of what he can do and his own worth. On my mother's side of the family, as immigrants from Jamaica, which as you and many of your listeners will know, it's a very interesting racial dynamic where there's almost a caste system in addition to a racial hierarchy. And my grandparents, my grandmother, very light skin, only a portion of black. My grandfather, darker skin, had this perception that they brought with them from Jamaica, which is that the lighter you were, the more likely you were to have more attractive prospects. That being dark-skinned was, in effect, a burden. And, you know, they lived that. When my grandmother went to try to find an apartment or a house for the family in Portland, Maine, she'd get shown some nice properties. And when she came with my grandfather, they all of a sudden weren't available. And, you know, my mother, you know, married my father, who was quite a bit darker-skinned than she was. You know, my grandmother brought with her, you know, some prejudice in that regard. But having said that, they were deeply committed to citizens in the African-American community, small as it was, in Portland, Maine. My grandfather founded the USO during World War II for what were then called colored troops that were stationed in Maine. And he brought, you know, great national figures, to including people like Marian Anderson, to visit the USO. And he was a big leader in his community and a champion for African-Americans, even as, you know, more subtly and arguably within the privacy of their own home, they had a little bit of condescension towards people who were darker. Having said both of those things, very different backgrounds, they shared a lot in common. One, a very strong commitment to education as the key to social and economic mobility. Secondly, a deep commitment to community and service, that to whom something is given, such as an education or an opportunity, much is expected. And so we were not allowed, certainly not in their generation, but not even in my generation with my brother, to slack. My parents' view was, you know, do your best and your best will be good enough, meaning you better bust your behind. It's okay to fail.
I'm laughing because we're the same vintage. Did your parents know my parents? My mom was from D.C.
Probably. You know, if you fail, it's okay. But if you fail because you didn't give it your best, that's not acceptable. So this commitment to family, to education, to service, to equality, really was pervasive on both sides of my family. And so I feel very blessed to have this legacy and to have that, you know, perspective of being granddaughter of an immigrant on one hand and granddaughter of slaves on the other.
My guest is Susan Rice. The name of her memoir is Tough Love, My Story of Things Worth Fighting For. You sit down to write your memoir. You've got to go back over through your life. How did you ensure that you were a reliable narrator?
You mean, how did I ensure that I had my facts straight?
Yeah, you experienced something one way. But was that really what happened?
Well, when it's my own life, Because I actually have never kept a journal for very deliberate reasons. I did have to rely on my own perceptions and recollections from my childhood for most immediately. Thankfully, my brother, who is close to me in age and close to me, period, was a very helpful second memory. And in fact, he has just a genius memory for funny stuff, small stuff, mm-hmm. color, humor. So he was very helpful in checking my recollections, as were other family members, cousins, and the like. But then we also were able to dig up some real useful documentary history, oral history that my father gave, a memoir that my uncle wrote, newspaper clippings, and you know, keepsakes that my mother had stuffed in a trunk, and photographs that we never knew my father had from his time in the war. And his family background. So we had this great opportunity to dig into our family history and discover things that we wouldn't otherwise. When it came to my recollections of my life as a public official, obviously the contents of this book are unclassified, and I had to rely not only on my own memories, but on the documentary record, which included, you know, newspaper articles, contemporaneous accounts, publicly available statements. So I did work hard to be sure that my recollections were accurate when it came to the issues that I recounted working on.
Your parents, you mentioned, were very serious about education. You tell a very funny story about applying to one of these Tony private schools, and you don't want to go. And on the way out the door, you're five, you're on the way out the door, you look in the fish tank of the headmistress, and you go like, hey, lady, your fish is dead.
And that's the only reason I got into the school, because much to my mother's absolute horror, I basically went on strike during the whole interview
process
for that school, and I said nothing. My mother was mortified. If I hadn't looked over my shoulder as I was walking out and noticed this fish floating on top of the tank and had a flip comment, I'm quite certain I would have ended up in a different school.
You ended up at a single-sex school.
National Cathedral School, yeah.
For about a decade, from fourth grade to graduation. What did you get out of going to a single-sex school?
It's really interesting. I actually think that for many girls, not all girls, single-sex education can be very valuable. They learn leadership skills. They learn to be a strong voice in the classroom. They learn their own worth. And it certainly was for me. I'm very skeptical on the flip side of the benefits of single-sex education for boys, quite honestly. Having grown up not only in my school, but with a brother's school at St. Albans, where my brother went and many of my good friends, and I think that single-sex education for boys can risk breeding a bit of misogyny, for lack of a better term, that some kids as grown-ups struggle to undo.
Especially when you couple it with privilege.
Especially when you couple it with privilege. But I also don't think that single-sex education is right for every girl. And I think, you know, even if you think it might be, not every school is right for every girl. My daughter went to my high school up through eighth grade and liked it very much, and I think got a lot out of it, but decided for high school she wanted to go to a co-ed school. And she's thriving and happy there. And I think in some ways, she's had the best of both worlds. She had some of the grounding in building her confidence and sense of self up through eighth grade, and now she's flourishing but also benefiting from being in school with boys and girls.
During your time as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, you describe it as a period of growth for you. What was the most important thing you took away from that experience?
I got my PhD, and I gained a background and a credential and an experience writing a full-length dissertation that was obviously very important. I also got to travel to Africa, to China, to then the Soviet Union during my tenure there. But in some ways, I think the best part of Oxford for me was the social aspect. I made very, very dear friends that I keep to this day. And we were in an environment, believe it or not, this is in the late 1980s. Not only was there no email, not only were there no cell phones, barely were there computers. For us to communicate with each other, we had to literally get on our bikes and ride over to our respective dorm rooms and hang out. And so time moved incredibly slowly. And there was just, you know, so much opportunity for leisure, for conversation, for intellectual growth and banter. So that personally was very valuable. And then I got to do fun things. I sang in a gospel choir for the first time, believe it or not, in Oxford, England. Some of my African-American friends set something up. I also got to act in a play for the first time. One of my dear friends decided she wanted to put on a production of Entezaki Shange's for color girls who considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. And, you know, you could barely find seven black women to fill that cast. And so my friend Terry Sewell, who's actually now a member of Congress from Alabama, put that together and roped all of her friends into participating in that play. So I had that kind of, you know, experience. It was just fun and outside the bounds of what I otherwise might have had a chance to do.
My guest is Susan Rice. The name of her memoir is Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. We'll talk policy, but we're going to take a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest is Susan Rice. The name of her memoir is Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. Please correct me if I'm wrong on any dates, but I do want to talk about your time working in the Clinton administration. There was this really interesting time when you write about having to make some compromises, some moral compromises to get the job done, that you write about being faced with thorny decisions about undemocratic leaders, right? And I think it's Eritrea, Rwanda, Ethiopia. You write, the unsavory compromise we had to make of prioritizing American security interests over our values became ever more costly and difficult to stomach. When you think back to that time and some of those decisions you had to make, why were they the right call at the time, even though they clearly were difficult?
Well, at the time, we're now talking about really the mid-1990s, in the wake of the Rwandan genocide, and with the rise of serious terrorist threat emanating from Sudan, in the region that we're discussing, which is essentially East and Central Africa. We worked with governments led by leaders at the time who, in the first instance, appeared to be reformist, both economically and politically, but turned out over time to be, in most instances, pretty traditional, comfortable in their power autocrats. They worked with us, though, in that period, to try to prevent another genocide in the region, whether in Burundi or Congo, and also work with us, very importantly, to try to contain the threat that came at that point from the government in Khartoum, Sudan, which was housing Osama bin Laden, backing al-Qaeda, and a whole bunch of other terrorist organizations. And so when I say we had to prioritize those security interests, we did, but not entirely to discount our concerns about human rights and democracy. And certainly elsewhere in Africa, we were very actively supporting, for example, the new democratic government in South Africa and the emergence of a new democracy in Nigeria after the dictator was deposed. But in this region, as I acknowledge, I think we had to make, we had to give greater weight to the security imperatives than I think certainly I was comfortable with at the time, and I'm even less comfortable with now and with the benefit of hindsight.
When you took on those positions in the Clinton administration, what was something that you wish you had known going in?
Well, you read that quotation, that self-description. That was when I was 32 years old and beginning a job at the State Department as the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, the youngest ever regional assistant secretary. I was not only an African-American woman and a breastfeeding mother, but at 32, most of the senior people who reported to me, including all of my ambassadors, were 20 to 30 years my age, older than me. And I was I think, prepared in terms of substance and knowledge because I'd been working on these issues at the White House. But I was not sufficiently steeped in how to manage a large bureau at the State Department, 48 embassies, 43 embassies in 48 countries. And I had to learn the hard way that the most direct way to implement a policy is not always going in a straight line from A to Z. Sometimes you have to slow down. Sometimes mm-hmm. you have to bring others on board and take a circuitous route. Be patient, which was not my forte then, and even something I struggle with today.
That comes up a lot, everybody.
So I learned, and thankfully, I learned in part because I received incredibly valuable, tough love from a colleague who took me aside about a year into my tenure when we were experiencing, you know, wars breaking out across the continent. We had suffered the terrorist attacks on our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. This is 1998. And he said to me, Susan, you know, you have all this talent. I want to see you succeed, but you're going to fail if you don't change the way you lead, change your management style, be less, you know, hard charging, less impatient, more respectful of the experience of your colleagues. And he was right. And I learned that real time. And I tried very hard to make adjustments, I think largely successfully, so that, you know, when I completed my tenure, I think I had, for the most part, not uniformly, but for the most part, gained the respect of the people I was working with, and in many cases, their friendship and affection. But, you know, that description of myself as a 32-year-old coming into the job, I think was accurate. And, you know, there are elements of that that I think probably applied 10 years or more later when I joined the Obama administration. But I think I'd grown in the process. I think I'd matured and learned from that experience so that by the time I led a large team again, I hope to, and I like to think, that many of those rough edges were sanded down.
Yeah, you write in the book, I learned that leadership is more like conducting a symphony than performing as a virtuoso player of any single instrument, often with multiple potentially dissonant musicians and the need to achieve harmony among them. I also found that securing the buy-in and the support of those career officials who will outlast any political appointee can be slow and cumbersome, but the extra effort and patience it takes to get there can pay lasting dividends. The most enduring outcomes are not always the swiftest ones. Indeed, the best route from point A to point B is not always a straight line, but could be a path with twists and turns. That's a hard lesson to learn, though, if you're a hard charger.
But it's essential. And I'm grateful that I had a colleague who was willing to put himself out there. He didn't need to sit me down and tell me this.
Why were you willing to listen to him? Because, as you said, you were a young black woman, a mom. You could have easily taken it as like, you're being sexist.
No.
Just because you trusted this guy?
It's because my parents had raised me that way. They had raised me with tough love. My father always said, when he was telling us something that we didn't want to hear in order to help us be better, understand this is coming from somebody with your best interests at mm-hmm. heart. That's how I heard the message from this colleague and friend, former Congressman Howard Wolpe. It's not just that I trusted him, although I did. It's that I could tell that he was doing this as a favor to me. If he wanted me to fail, he could have just said nothing and let mm-hmm. me drive off a cliff. You know, he did this as an act of friendship and generosity. And even in the moment, that was apparent to me, as hard as his message was to digest.
Did you ever have to pay that forward?
Or have absolutely. And this is, again, you know, not only was I raised with tough love and I've tried to raise my kids that way, it's also how I've led my teams and in government. And I love my colleagues fiercely, but not uncritically, which to me mm-hmm. is the definition of tough love. So when I came across young, brash people who I saw a little bit of myself in and thought that they could benefit from a little bit of wisdom that I'd learned the hard way over the years, I would certainly give it to them. You know, I've tried to mentor back, as I've been very fortunate to be mentored by people like Madeleine Albright mm-hmm. And many others in a way that has enabled me to grow and become who I am.
There are three people in the book who you are clear that you have issues with.
Only three.
Well, the three that stood out to me, and the, I'm only going to ask you to dive into one of them. Holbrooke. Richard Holbrooke attempted to steamroll you on more than one occasion and insert himself in your world. You did respectfully with Senator McCain, who derailed, campaigned loudly against you for Secretary of State. And then Edward Snowden, which I found interesting because he's just released a memoir as well.
That's an odd trio.
But it was those three that stuck out to me for whatever reason.
Holbrooke, I get. McCain, I end the book with...
You're very respectful about it.
Acknowledgement of how much I do respect him.
Absolutely. I want to make sure that's clear. But it was tough there for a minute. But with Snowden, you write about Snowden. The damage Snowden caused to U.S. national security cannot be overstated. Those who praise him as a whistleblower and a hero have no idea what they're talking about. Snowden deserves a full reckoning with the U.S. justice system, which I am confident would render the punishment he has earned. Instead, he remains coddled in Moscow, where he escaped to the warm embrace of our committed adversary and precipitated the sharp ongoing decline in the U.S.-Russian relations. Snowden's picture ought to be in the dictionary next to the definition of traitor. Just to remind people, he took and copied what was evidence of mass collection of data of U.S. citizens, and then he went to Hong Kong.
He stole millions of very sensitive documents. Yes.
Went to Hong Kong and then shared them to journalists. With journalists,
and
right?
Presumably with his hosts in Moscow.
When people think about, when you talk about the damage, can you just give a real concrete example?
I can give you a concrete example in general form because this really remains highly, highly classified. And I recognize that I'm making an assertion that I can't in print back up with detailed facts.
Understood.
But understand that the nature of what he stole and disclosed exposed some of the most important methods that the United States government has to keep Americans safe. And I'm talking about safe from things like terrorist attacks, most urgently, but other kinds of deadly threats. And that information redounds to the benefit only of our adversaries. And as I say in the book, the consequences are lasting. To this day, we are less capable in some respects of protecting the people of New York City from another terrorist attack because of Edward Snowden.
My guest is Susan Rice. The name of her book is Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. In this book, you have an opportunity to address Benghazi. I'll try to give the nutshell version. You did what they called the full Ginsburg. You went on all the morning shows. You weren't scheduled to do so, right?
You weren't planning to do so.
You were a good soldier. You went out. You led with the information at the time. I think anybody who has ever worked in news for more than 2 minutes knows the first information is often incorrect. And you became a target. You became a real target of the right.
Good summary.
Thank you. What would you have told a friend if this had happened to a friend?
Before or after?
During. So your friend comes to you and says, oh my gosh, this is happening to me. This thing has blown up. One of the things, you couldn't defend yourself. You really couldn't. And it was your brother who said you acted like a girl in doing this?
Yeah, what he meant by that.
You took it for the team.
Let me be clear. Because my brother, God bless him, is sensitive about that statement because he doesn't want it to be misconstrued. So first of all, there was the question of, you know, what could one do once this had begun and you're under assault? And frankly, I don't know that I could advise anybody to do anything much differently than I did in that moment, which was to keep my head down, do my job, keep representing the U.S. to the rest of the world, negotiate what I had to negotiate at the U.N., and try to shield my family. And in that respect, because my young daughter, who is 9 years old, and my mother, who had just had her fourth or fifth cancer surgery and a stroke, really were deeply affected by this. And I, I feel badly, and I think my husband does too, that we didn't turn off the television early enough to protect my young daughter. Those are the kinds of things that I could control. But then the period in which my brother was giving me the advice about how to perhaps have acted in retrospect was after the election, when it was reported that I was being considered, along with John Kerry, to become
Secretary of State.
And what Johnny was suggesting that I should have done, which again runs counter to my instincts, was to be more aggressive in promoting myself for that job, and to do what he was saying a man would do, which is to, mm-hmm. you know, be all out there and campaign for himself. I couldn't do that, not because I was a woman, because I'm quite capable of standing up for myself. I couldn't do it because I don't believe that it was appropriate for me to try to influence my boss and my friend as to what decision he should make. That's his decision. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel like, you know, by ginning up outside supporters or letters or, you know, whatever, that was appropriate. So I think what John was saying is, one has to be more of an advocate for themselves, and that my greatest strength and my greatest weakness, as he often tells me, is that I put mission first, that I'm about whatever is the larger objective, and insufficiently sometimes worried about how it might affect me or the ones closest to me. It's good advice. I mean, it's very uncomfortable advice for me, because it just, you know, doesn't accord with my instincts. But I also write in the book how my mother, before I went on the Sunday shows, almost intuitively and presciently warned me not to do it. She sensed that this was going to go badly wrong. Mm-hmm. And she was right, for the reason you said, that, you know, often the first information, no matter, you know, how well vetted and accurate it is in the moment, it changes. And in a hothouse of a political campaign, you know, for the reelection of the president, where the partisans, you know, spears are flying, that as the messenger, I was as likely to be attacked as the message was, in the event that it proved inaccurate, which it did ultimately in one respect. So I had important learnings to do. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, with the support and the wisdom of my friends, of my family, of my colleagues. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm proud to have served. I don't regret in any way, shape, or form having stepped into the arena, even as mm-hmm. I've, you know, sustained my share of attacks. I believe deeply in this country, and I believe good people need to be willing to stand up and serve, even when it's hard. And, you know, I try to be very frank in the book all along the way about where I've learned, where mm-hmm. I've made mistakes, things I'm proud of. Because, you know, nobody bats 1,000 in this league. Nobody. And the people who I have the most admiration for are the ones that are able to call honest balls and strikes and say, here's, you know, where I got it right and here's where I didn't.
Did you want to be Secretary of State?
Yes, I did. But I also, and believe it or not, I'd long wanted to be National Security Advisor. And that was my first job in government, was at the National Security Council on the NSC staff. My first two jobs in government, mm-hmm. in fact. And what I knew about that role, which bore out, was how incredibly impactful it is. You're at the right hand of the president every single day. You are the first voice and the last voice as he has to make the toughest decisions. You're leading the interagency principles process as a coordinated team, hopefully. And you are working on a hugely wide range of issues, frankly, much wider than I worked on as UN ambassador, or even than one works on as Secretary of State, because it involves intelligence, it involves law enforcement, mm-hmm. defense issues, budget issues. So I also knew how important and exciting that job was. It's a very different role. The Secretary of State's negotiating, they're involved in diplomacy, flying all over the world. Yes, I would have liked that job. But looking back on it, I don't think I'd trade having the privilege of serving as Barack Obama's national security advisor, even for the opportunity to be Secretary of State. And, you know, I don't live one day, you know, feeling like I was screwed or put upon or, you know, lost out. And I feel really fortunate and proud to have been able to serve and to serve that president with a great team on behalf of our country. And I'll always be very grateful for that privilege.
What should reporters in the next few weeks be asking about what's going on with Syria, with the Kurds? What's a question, a really good question, that could get to some answers, that could move that story forward?
Well, Allison, the question that I am wrestling with is, why did President Trump wake up and make that decision?
I said this to a friend. I said, you know, I can imagine the president wakes up and thinks about trade, wakes up and thinks about the wall.
No, but look,
I can't imagine wakes up and...
But here's the thing.
Somebody benefits from this.
That's what I'm saying. Like, we've just learned that in the president's engagements with the Ukrainians, the Chinese, he's asking for favors for himself in exchange for very important things that the United States can give, whether it's military assistance to a Ukraine that's militarily on the ropes under Russian occupation, or a White House visit for a brand new elected leader of Ukraine, or with the Chinese, the implication that, you know, if they manufacture some fake dirt on Joe Biden, that maybe the trade dispute that we're in the middle of, the trade war, and our various security concerns with China might be resolved in a fashion that is acceptable or beneficial to the Chinese. So when you hear that immediately after a phone call with President Erdogan, who is a slippery, slimy character, that all of a sudden the president, without consulting anybody on his national security team, has ordered the withdrawal of U.S. forces. Even though you might stipulate, well, he said he didn't want, you know, stay involved in the Middle East. These are not large numbers of U.S. forces,
not
and they're not ground troops involved in combat. These are hundreds of advisors who have, you know, worked very effectively with our partners, the Kurds. You've got to ask, what happened in that phone call? What made him do something so detrimental to our national security that even the Republicans in Congress are up in arms? I want to know what the quid pro quo was, because I don't believe there wasn't one. And if there wasn't one, if we've got a president who gave up our national security for absolutely nothing because he's a wimp and got rolled in a phone call by Erdogan, then he's equally unfit. So one way or another, we need to understand what, you know, what made him do that.
The name of the book is Tough Love, My Story of Things Worth Fighting For. Susan Rice, thanks for spending so much time with us.
It was great to be with you, Allison. Thank you.
This is All of It on WNYC.